Welcome to the ACC Podcast. We hope these messages are a source of growth for you in your spiritual walk with Jesus, or maybe you're just checking us out for the first time. Whoever you are or wherever you come from, we want you to know that we love you, and so does Jesus. If you're thinking of attending ACC, we're currently holding one service at 10 a.m. on Sunday mornings, in person and online. You can watch live or get directions or other information directly from our website, anacortischristian.church. That's A-N-A-C-O-R-T-E-S, Christian.church. So, whether you're sitting, driving, running, or hiking, thanks for tuning in. Let's dive into the Bible together.
Good morning. For those that might not know me, that are new, or maybe checking us out online, my name is Brian Nelson. I'm the youth minister here at ACC, and I actually have the privilege this morning of talking to you, and just so excited about it. Just what we're going to be in today, just being able to dig in with you and look at God's Word. There's some really awesome stuff I'm excited to share with you. And so far, I mean, I almost burned the church down over here, if you didn't notice that. And so I didn't. So the morning's already off to a good start. So I'm already feeling pretty good about that. But I just wanted to just start off really talking. We just finished an incredible song about music. You know, music is a powerful force. I mean, wouldn't you agree? There's just something about it. I was downstairs this morning in my office, kind of prepping, studying, getting ready for today, and that last song came on, God With Us, and just something about it just caught me, and I couldn't do anything but just stop and listen to it. And that's what music can do, though, right? It has a way of like getting a hold of you and the ability to just take emotions and either alter them or heighten them, you know, whether it's happiness or sadness or worship. It could be nostalgia, you know, that idea of taking you back to a memory or romance or relaxation or energy. The right music can make a moment. And music, it honestly plays a significant role in my life. So kind of moment of transparency. I think those that are closest to me will testify to this, those that live with me. I tend to struggle with anxiety. And what I mean by that is my kind of natural default is to just run on edge pretty much most of the time. And what I've discovered over the years is that music is really been a way to kind of help mellow me out, you know, and so I use it that way. I've got a playlist on my phone titled Relaxation. It's got some of my feel-good songs on it that I can go to. When I get really stressed over the top and I need to just pull out the big guns, I've got an island music playlist. It's got Kenny Chesney, Zach Brown, Jimmy Buffett, and so that is like my go-to when I'm just over the top. Some island music, I go to the kitchen, and I clean the kitchen, and I just pretend like I'm on a sandy beach, and that is my go-to for when I'm like really stressed and I really need to decompress. But music also plays a huge role in my devotional life. I don't know about you, but it's a lot of times it's hard for me to transition. You know, you have the hustle and bustle of life, and you're going in so many different directions, and there's moments where you just, right, God tells us to be still and just to know He's God, and for me, at times, it's hard to make that transition, especially throughout the day. And often when I sit down to study or reflect or write or even prep a message, I'll put on some soft instrumental music. A lot of times it's worship music. Sometimes it's some other variations, but it's soft, it's peaceful. And it just helps me prepare my mind and my spirit to like just better enter a space where I'm able to receive what God wants to show me. I mean, that's my routine. I'm just kind of setting the stage here. And so that's what I was doing on Wednesday afternoon. I was sitting at my kitchen table. I was actually preparing for this message on Mark 3, going through some study materials. And then something strange happened that I honestly had never really experienced before. for the first time ever, the music that usually helps me focus was actually acting like a roadblock. I couldn't figure it out. I didn't understand what was going on. I couldn't connect the dots. And then all of a sudden I realized that the music that I was listening to, it didn't match the mood of the moment that I was encountering when I was studying and getting into Mark 3, which is what we're going to talk about today. You see, often when we reflect on Jesus, our thoughts, they jump to peace and to mercy and to compassion and to hope. And for obvious reasons, we ought to. But we don't normally think of Jesus as a fighter. But that's a significant part of the book of Mark. And honestly, that's what I was being hit with as I was studying Mark 3. And so I did something drastic, something I honestly thought I would never do. I turned off my nice, peaceful instrumental tunes, and I replaced them with my fight music. It's the stuff that I listen to when, like, I don't feel like working out, but I need to get worked up to work out, and I feel like I'm fighting against my mind and my body, and so I turn up the fight music to, like, get ramped up to actually, like, work out and just do what I really probably not feeling like doing. And so that was the music that I chose to put on. That was the music that I needed coursing through my veins to set the tone as I entered the world of Mark 3. And so the reason I'm sharing this with you is because I want you to have a chance to get into that mentality too, like to mentally prepare what's in store for us today. Because we're going to see Jesus, as we do all through the book of Mark, Jesus is coming for a fight. And we're going to see that here. As much as I love him being the image of being a peacemaker, and he is the Prince of Peace, you know, I so often overlook the fact Jesus came to this world to pick a fight. You know, if I were to summarize the book of Mark, this is how I would summarize it. And this is something you can kind of look, as you look back and you look forward, you can think of it in these terms. So in Mark's gospel, you've had an internal uprising in God's world. And so Jesus has come as he is a returning king. He is coming to the world that he created. He's coming to the kingdom he created. And he's coming for one reason. He's coming to take back his kingdom. And just spoiler alert, he's not going to do it through negotiation, okay? It's going to be through force. And so that's the picture that we see, right? Wherever he goes, this king is like an unstoppable force. He is crushing opponents on his way to what we're going to see starting in chapter 11. He's on his way to an ultimate showdown, which will culminate in the capital city of Jerusalem on Passover, with two heavyweights going toe-to-toe in a death match, each side wanting to end the other. I feel like a boxing promoter here. But that's what we see. We're seeing everything's working up to Passover, to Jerusalem, to this heavyweight bout. And I want you to be thinking as we go forward, who is that enemy that Jesus is going to fight? Who is that other heavyweight? Because we see him actually kind of fighting several groups on different fronts. We're going to talk more about who is that heavyweight that Jesus is going to meet in Jerusalem on Passover. But in Mark 3, we're going to get a small taste of what's going to happen in Jerusalem. For a moment, before we get into the text, I just want to rewind and just set the scene of what we've seen so far, because that's going to help us understand what's going on as we get into Mark 3. So here we go. From the moment that Jesus stepped on the stage back in chapter 1, he's been anything but passive. Like he's not trying to fly under the radar. He's angry, but just let me clarify, it's a righteous anger. There's a difference between like my anger most of the time and what Jesus is experiencing. Let me kind of spell this out. We actually read this last week. It's in chapter 3, verse 5. It says, "And he, Jesus, looked around at the religious leaders with anger." And what was he angry about? He was not only angry, it says he was grieved. There's something about what he saw in these religious leaders that it made him angry, but you could see the love that he had for them, the grief that he experienced because of what they were doing. And it says he was angry at the hardness of their hearts. He was angry at what was taking place inside and how it was destroying them and what it was causing them to do. And so we see that. We see Jesus coming with this righteous anger, and he is actively looking for and engaging in conflict. And he's not worried about being nice. So just think about what we've seen so far. He's already gone out to Satan. He's the one that initiated that interaction with Satan. And what happens? He takes Satan on in the wilderness, and he defeats Satan. And we're going to come back to that. I think personally, he bound Satan up some way in that exchange. Whatever happened in the wilderness, we know Jesus came out on top, and it had implications. And then what else do we see? We see he continually is encountering in these exorcisms, right? He's encountering Satan's minions, these demons, and he's just tossing them aside like they're nothing. Like, it reminds me of like a Chuck Norris movie where he's got like 10 guys coming at him and you see guys flying all over the place. You know, that's kind of what I see with Jesus, is he's encountering these demons and they're trying to fight back. They're actually calling out his name, and that was a tactic they used to try to get the upper hand in an exorcism. If you could claim the other one's name, then you could try to get out on top, and it does nothing for them. You know, basically just Jesus, they declare he is, and he just tells them to get out and go, and they just tosses them out. It's like they're not even a contest. And then we also see him on several occasions, he goes out of his way to call out Israel's religious leaders. Now, this is interesting. If you'll go back, like, I always had the picture of these religious leaders like confronting Jesus and Jesus like interacting with them. That's really not the case. Go back and look at what's happened so far. Look at what we're going to see today. Look at what happens going forward. And it's really not what's happening. What you have is these scribes, these Pharisees, these religious leaders. They're either thinking something to themselves, or they're mumbling something amongst themselves, kind of snickering or making snide comments about Jesus. And then Jesus kind of pulls like the ultimate teacher move. Do I've got any teachers in here? Any teachers? I used to be a teacher. I did this all the time, right? You got somebody in the back, kind of class clown. They're making comments. They're doing, and so you just stop everything, right? And you make a scene. I mean, Jesus could have easily let this stuff go, and he doesn't. It's like, you guys have something you want to share, why don't you come to the front of the class, right, and share it with everybody. And that's how Jesus handles these religious leaders. He calls them out. Things that he could have easily let go, he intentionally makes a big scene out of it. And so we have, you know, Jesus, he is looking for conflict. He is looking for a fight. And for one reason, because he is bringing something that attention needs to be brought to. And so all of this stuff, right, it's all this building tension, it can really be encapsulated in something that we read last week that Mike talked about. You know, it's the new versus the old. And so Jesus, yeah, he talked in parables, and he talked about like having a new patch on an old garment and how that wouldn't work because it would destroy the garment. He talked about like new wine into old wineskins would burst them. You need new wineskins for new wine, right? And at the heart of that message was this. It was, in short, something new and better has come. And Jesus is saying, that's me. And it's incompatible with the old, which is you. The Pharisees, religious leaders, you're out of date. We're going to come back to this phrase over and over today. It's the old way of seeing and doing things cannot contain the new stuff that Jesus is bringing. It just can't. If we were to give this in a modern picture, you know, this is kind of Jesus is giving like older images that would have been pertinent to the Jewish people back then. If we were to make this new, it would be something like this. Do we have a picture up there? Can you put it up there? Does anybody know what that is? Raise your hand if you know what that is. Now, I want you to look around and notice, I don't see any teenagers raising their hand. And there's a reason why. Because that is obsolete. It doesn't exist anymore. That, teenagers, here's your lesson for today of history. That is what we call a floppy disk, okay? And so when I was your age, that's how I played games on the computer. I had my floppy disk that I put in to play whatever I wanted to, and it would load up, and it would take forever and all this stuff. But that's how it happened. We don't have that. That has been obsolete for at least 20, I don't even want to date myself here, 25 years, we'll just say, 20 years. And so there's a good reason why you don't know what that is, because that is completely incompatible with anything we have today. And that's essentially, if Jesus were talking to the Pharisees right now, that's essentially what he's saying. You guys are a bunch of floppy disks, okay? You can't handle the new stuff that's coming. You're not, and so you need to either jump on board or you need to get out of the way. And here's what we see. We see them, these religious leaders, the way they respond, they immediately go and they're wanting to eliminate Jesus. We left off last week, right? Jesus was healing the man with the withered hand on the Sabbath. And this is what this will get us into the text for today. It's what it says. The Pharisees went out and immediately held counsel with the Herodians, which were basically the Romans, against him on how to destroy him. This is their response to Jesus' teaching and him bringing new stuff. And so how does Jesus respond? And this is where we get into our text for today. So if you've got a Bible out, you can look on the screen. We're going to be in Mark 3, verse 7. And this is what it says. Jesus withdrew with his disciples to the sea. Now, quick point of reference here. When it says disciples, he's not talking about the 12. He's talking about the whole group that's following Jesus at this point. We're actually going to get to the 12 today. But right now, disciples is slang for, or it's a term for just everybody who's chosen to follow Jesus. Okay? So Jesus, he withdraws with his disciples. Notice where he withdraws to the sea. And so what we have here, right? Jesus, the returning king, is engaging in battle with Satan's forces who have been shown to have invaded and enslaved the lives of God's people. And so that heavyweight that we were talking about a little bit earlier, that's Satan. That's his kingdom. But he has groups that are working for him. He's got what I would call minions. And we see it in two groups. We see it with the demons that he fights and Jesus cast out. And then we see it through Israel's religious leaders who have enslaved through their corrupt authority. They've burdened people. They've enslaved people. And this passage, interestingly enough, is going to tie both of those, the demons and the religious leaders together. And so Jesus, what has he done? He has reached out directly to these leaders. He's been very forthright. He's tried to convince them of who he is. He's presented them with evidence. He's done miracles. He's been pretty direct. And all it's led to is them feeling like they need to eliminate him. So Jesus now withdraws from the synagogues. Now, this is important. He's not withdrawing out of fear. He's withdrawing because the synagogues were like the official place where people preached. This is where the religious leaders held their sphere of influence. And so what is that saying here? Jesus, he's withdrawing from this official place of preaching, and he's going out to the sea. He's going out to the masses, and that's where the preaching's going to take place. He's not going to enter. He will enter one more synagogue. It's back in his hometown. I think there's a reason for that. But besides that, Jesus will not step foot in another synagogue, at least not by Mark's account. He's going out to the people. And what's the response? Let's continue. It says, Jesus withdrew with his people following him, his disciples, to the sea, and a great crowd followed him. So this doesn't diminish Jesus' popularity, it just increases it. And where are they coming from? They're coming from Galilee. They're coming from Judea and Jerusalem and Idumea and from beyond the Jordan and around Tyre and Sidon. When the great crowd heard all that he was doing, they came to him. Now check this out. And he told his disciples to have a boat ready for him because of the crowd, lest they crush him. For he had healed so many that all who had diseases pressed around him to touch him. And whenever the unclean spirits saw him, they fell down before him and cried out, "You are the Son of God," and he strictly ordered them not to make him known. All right, so let's just pause for a minute, take a breath, and just imagine this scene. The crowds, they are coming from everywhere. And it's interesting that Mark even mentions they're coming from outside of Israel. So it's not just Israel coming to him, it's the places outside of Israel that are also coming to him as well. I think that's significant. They're coming to see Jesus. And let's be honest, they're most likely less interested in what he is saying than what he can do for them. I think that Mark makes that pretty clear. But this is how they're going to hear, right? They come to Jesus, they see the healings, but then they get to hear the preaching as well. And just the intensity of everything is just growing, it's swelling. The crowds have grown. Again, just the tension, the feeling, the intensity is growing. People, they're no longer content on waiting for Jesus. Instead, they are outright willing to crush Jesus to get what they want. Just think about that for a minute. There's not really a sense of caring about Jesus' well-being. They're willing to crush him if it means they get what they want. They want to take. Now, before you and I judge this crowd too harshly, I think we can be honest and just say, I know I would be a part of that crowd. I think probably a lot of you would too. I mean, just think about it. If I can get one touch of this guy, my ailments are gone. You know, I think about Luke and when what we went through when we found out he had autism and just kind of trying to find any way we could to help him. I could tell you right now, if I was in that situation and Jesus was coming to town, I'd be tossing Luke over the top of the crowd to try to just get him to tackle Jesus, right? Just any type of touch. I'd be that desperate. I'd be forcing my way through the crowds. I'd be doing whatever I can. I would be right with this crowd, ready to crush Jesus. But here is where I am just so in awe of Jesus. And I think you ought to be too, because just his love and his compassion and his overall ability just to maintain his sanity in these conditions. I mean, just put yourself in his place and your people coming and trying to grab you. And you know what? But Jesus, he sees these people for who they really are. I mean, they're not the enemy. They're the people who Jesus has come to free. They're the enslaved. They've been enslaved by demons and sickness and just the garbage of this world and just the burdens that are being put in on them by the religious system. And I mean, these are the people that Jesus has come to free. These are the enslaved. And so he's able to see them and he's able to free them. And I think we could learn a lot as a church from that, just that picture right there of how we see people. And so he cast out the enemy. You know, they try to, again, call him out by name, trying to gain an upper edge. And, you know, Jesus just, like it's nothing, he just cast them out. And what do? Did you catch that? The only thing they can do, they bow at his feet before the king as Jesus tells them to shut up and get out. Every knee will bow. Even rebellious demons. And so we continue. And he went on in verse 13, and he went up on the mountain. Now, let's hold up for a minute. Where are my students at? This is the most participation I'm gonna ask from you, okay? I just want you to look up at me, students, okay? And then nod your head for yes or no if you understand what I'm talking about here. Okay, so this is where we're at, right? As a youth group, we have been talking for the past month and a half about the importance of images, correct? Right? Okay. And how the Bible uses them to convey spiritual truth. These images, you know, they mean one thing on the surface, but as you get into them and you see them and you study them and see how the Bible uses them, they are a means of communicating some greater spiritual reality. And the Bible's full of these images, and you can really trace them all through the Bible. And it's been kind of cool, right? Because we've been studying the sea, correct? Right? Yeah, I see. Okay, thank you, Liam. We've been studying the sea, and we've been tracing the sea for the last few weeks. And it's neat because in Mark, we see this image of the sea being used over and over and over, and that means something. And so my hope is that, you know, it's causing you guys to stop and look and think about it. So here's a quick lesson. There's actually two more really important images that we are running into in this next section. All right, so the two images are mountains and the number 12. And here's what we've said about these images. Anytime that we run into one of these images, it's kind of like a metal detector, right? As you're reading, it should send alarms off. And it just causes us to stop and dig a little bit deeper, because behind that image, there is something underneath the surface that's super important. Especially like when we run into mountain in the book of Mark, because we're only going to hit it once or twice, two or three times. Okay, and this is one of them. And so what's going on here? Let's do a little digging. Okay, Jesus, he goes up on a mountain. And so first off, anytime the Bible says something happens on a mountain, it's pretty much always significant. Mountains are places where God does really special things. And so we want to make sure that we don't just move past this fact and just brush it off. Something special is going on here. And so this is what it says. And he went up on the mountain and called to him those whom he desired, and they came to him. So this is kind of the picture we get, right? We've got the big crowd that's come. It's now thinned out, and you're left with Jesus' followers, those people that have chosen to follow him. And now from those group of followers, Jesus is going to call 12. And this is where we see it. So he's gone up on a mountain, and it says he called to him those whom he desired, and they came to him. And he appointed 12, remember we said that's important, whom he also named the apostles, so that they might be with him, and he might send them out to preach and have authority to cast out demons. And so that's going to be their role. These are going to be the people that spend the most time witnessing, observing, learning at the feet of Jesus, and they're going to be the ones that Jesus sends out as his representatives. And so he appointed the 12. Now, we get their names, but here's the reality. Their names aren't near as important as what they signify as a group. They are the 12. That's how they're going to be referred to throughout. A lot of these people, we're not going to hear their names again, you know, but they are part of the 12. So let's go. Since most of them, we're not going to hear their names again, I want to at least give them some recognition here. And so these are the 12. Simon, to whom he gave the name Peter. Interesting fact, he'll call him Peter the rest of the time, except for a very specific incident at the very end of the book where he calls him Simon again. You got James, the son of Zebedee and John, the brother of James, to whom he gave the name the Sons of Thunder. It's a really cool wrestling name right there. Just, we're on the fight topic. I thought that was neat. Andrew and Philip, Bartholomew, Matthew, Thomas, James, the son of Alphaeus, and Thaddeus, and Simon the Zealot, and Judas Iscariot, who betrayed him. These are the 12. So here's the question. This is happening on a mountain. What is significant about this? You know, it takes us back to Exodus 19 and 20. You know, God is on Mount Sinai, and he commissioned the nation of Israel to be his people. That's really where it took place. And you remember our theme, right? We're going to keep coming back to it. The old can't contain the new. And so what is Jesus doing here? You know, just as God appointed the leadership for the nation of Israel up on a mountain, Jesus right here, he is rejecting and replacing the current leaders of Israel, and he's rejecting the synagogues as the way of preaching truth. So he's rejecting these things, and he's going to replace them with new leadership and a new voice. And he's essentially restoring the 12 tribes of Israel. He's creating a new Israel. And he is claiming to be their leader. Jesus is taking on the role of God in this narrative right here. That's significant. I mean, this is a big deal. So you've got the new leadership that Jesus just established. up on a mountain. They come down the mountain, right? And as we move on into the passage, we're going to encounter something that I think Mark will do all through this book. It's a technique called sandwiching. Okay, so this is really the first instance we're going to see it, so I want to point it out. But sandwiching is, and if you want to do something fun, this lets you know what a nerd I am because I think this is fun. But go through the book of Mark, right? And look at the times where Jesus does this, because it happens quite a bit, where Jesus, Mark will start one story, and then you think he's going to finish it, he abruptly stops it, he starts another story, finishes that, and then he comes back to the original story and finishes it. So it's like a sandwich, right? You've got one story that's been divided, and you've got a middle story, and it's Mark's way of relating two stories together that they speak to one another. They give us insight on each other. It's Mark's way of relating the two things together. And so we've got a sandwich right here. I want to point it out. So starting in verse 20, it says, "Then he went home." So they've come down the mountain. They've went home. "The crowd has gathered again so that they could not even eat. And when his family, his biological family, heard it, they went out to seize him, for they were saying he's out of his mind." Now, I'm expecting the very next thing to happen is, okay, so what happens with that? But Mark doesn't give us that right away. Instead, Mark jumps to another story. He goes to the scribes, and he says this, "And the scribes who came down from Jerusalem were saying, he's possessed by Beelzebul, and by the prince of demons, he cast out the demons. And he called them to him and said to them in parables," this is Jesus talking to them, "how can Satan cast out Satan? If a kingdom is divided against itself, that kingdom can't stand. And if a house is divided against itself, that house will not be able to stand. And if Satan has risen up against himself and is divided, he cannot stand, but is coming to an end." And then Jesus gives a really interesting little parable. He says, "But no one can enter a strong man's house and plunder his goods unless he first binds the strong man. Then indeed he may plunder his house." And so real quick, I just want to kind of interpret that parable real quick just so we can move on for the sake of time. And so in that, when it says, "But no one can enter a strong man's house," the strong man's house, the strong one is Satan. His house is the present world, which he's kind of taken over. And his goods would be the people that he's enslaved. And so if that's the case, then it says, unless there's a stronger one that comes that would bind him, and that stronger one is Jesus, who's come from God. He's invaded Satan's stronghold, and he has bound him up. That's really the meaning of the parable. And I think that has, I really do, and this is just my personal opinion, I think this has something to do, there was some type of like binding on a spiritual level that took place in the desert, in the wilderness, when Satan and Jesus first met. That's my personal opinion. That now what you see is Jesus is the stronger one who's come, and he's just wreaking havoc on Satan's house. He's pillaging the things that are Satan, that Satan thought were his possessions, human lives, and he's freeing them. And he's doing this everywhere he goes. And so just think about it, because this is a lot to take in, but just stop and think about this picture real quick. So Jesus, right, we've just said, he's just created a new leadership for a new Israel. They've come down from a mountain, and who was the first people they encounter? It says they encounter the old regime, the current leadership, who's also come down from a mountain, the Temple Mountain. And they've come down, and now they have met in, I guess, the valley, if you want to call it that. And they're looking for, these religious leaders, they're looking for trouble. We've got ourselves a showdown here. And so they, you know, these religious leaders, they're kind of in the background. They're just listening, observing. And they begin kind of snickering to themselves, making snide comments, thinking the reason he cast out demons is because he's possessed by Satan or Beelzebub, the prince of the demons. And Jesus will have none of this. Again, he could have let this slide. They're not really making that big of a scene, I don't think. But instead, he calls them out. He says, why don't you come up to me, guys? Let's talk about this. Again, this is not a man that's looking to fly under the radar. He's the one that initiates the confrontation. You know, the new and the old are face-to-face in front of this capacity crowd. This is a teaser to what's going to happen later on in Jerusalem. And Jesus speaks to them again through a parable. Now, I'm going to give my paraphrase here. You've already read, so at least you've read what Mark said. This is how I would paraphrase what Jesus is telling them. It's like, guys, do you realize how ridiculous you sound right now? You know, stop it. You're embarrassing yourselves. Why would Satan attack his own forces? If that's the case, then either there's a civil war that's going on in the kingdom, or he is inexplicably attacking himself, which means he's either crazy or irrational. And either way, it means the same thing. His kingdom is falling apart, which, again, that's the only explanation there could be. However, guys, there's another explanation that you're failing to consider. Isn't it just possible that there is someone stronger than Satan that has come on the scene, and that this person who has overpowered him and who is now raiding his house, that would mean that what is taking place is not an inside job, but it's a direct attack from the outside, from an outside opponent who's stronger than he is. And wouldn't you want to be on that guy's side? I mean, that's essentially what Jesus is telling him here. And again, we know how they respond. They've already decided they're going to eliminate Jesus. But it's interesting. Jesus, he doesn't let up there. Like, he stays on the attack. He's accusing these religious leaders from Jerusalem of having committed an eternal, like, unpardonable sin by blaspheming against the Holy Spirit, accusing Jesus of working for Satan. This is what Jesus tells them. He says, truly, I say to you, talking to the religious leaders, all sins will be forgiven the children of man, and whatever blasphemies they utter, but whoever blasphemes against the Holy Spirit never has forgiveness, but is guilty of an eternal sin, for they were saying he has an unclean spirit. So the religious leaders, they confront this. They're forced to run home with their tail between their legs and kind of go off in shame. They've been defeated, and we're going to move on. But here's what I want to do. Before we move on, I have to be careful because there's a lot of rabbit holes we can go down. There's a lot of good stuff here. This is actually a rabbit hole I think is worth going down. Doesn't have a lot to do with the whole overall message that we're presenting here, but it's this idea of the unpardonable sin. Because I hear, you know, especially with students and talking, you know, I hear a lot of talk about, you know, the unpardonable sin. Whether it's like speculating on it, trying to figure out what it is, obsessing over it, being like worried that maybe I've done it and like causing like some unnecessary grief. I want to kind of clarify that just for a minute. First of all, when we talk about the unpardonable sin, I think we immediately assume, we get this picture of like this one sin, you know, that if we commit it, it's going to like just do us in. And it's unforgivable, and so we can't recover from it. And that is not the picture that we get here at all. That's not the picture that is being presented. Jesus, he's talking about blasphemy. Blasphemy is, in short, it's basically just attacking another's reputation, slandering them. And so the point that Jesus is bringing out is that it's one thing to blaspheme people. That's bad. It's forgivable. It's another thing to blaspheme the Holy Spirit because that's on a different level. And so I want you to catch this. What we're witnessing with Jesus addressing this group of individuals, it's a people who have hardened their hearts to the point, like so terribly, that they are looking straight into the face of God in flesh, ultimate source of goodness, and they're accusing him of being possessed by Satan. They're looking at what the Holy Spirit is doing through Jesus, and they're attributing it to the work of Satan. Now, you cannot get any more blind or any more hardened than that. That's what's going on here. That's what Jesus is speaking into. And so it's not this idea that there's just this one sin that is a one-time deal breaker. This is a process of continual sin that has been happening till like you've hit rock bottom and you've hardened your heart. It seems like maybe to the point of no return when you see Jesus and you claim he's Satan. That's bad, okay? And so that's what Jesus is talking about here. But through the Bible, there's an overarching emphasis on repentance where there's forgiveness. I would even argue, I think maybe this is hyperbole here, that it's an exaggeration, because you can look at someone like Paul. And Paul would honestly, I think, probably lump himself in this category. And yet Paul says, you know, I was the greatest blasphemer of all, but Jesus took me in. You know, I've changed, you know, and all that past stuff is just in the past. And so what I want to make sure we understand is that, you know, this idea, it's not a one-time deal breaker. And even if you're worried about it, you know, then that's just evidence that you're not struggling with this, because your heart's soft enough where you're actually concerned. And so that's my spiel on this unpardonable sin. Hopefully it clarifies some things, not really having a lot to do with what the picture we're receiving in the message, but I felt like it was a rabbit hole to chase down. And so let's get back to the message, okay? Let's get back to where we are in the passage. We've addressed the middle of the sandwich, right? We've addressed the scribes. We've addressed their response and how Jesus calls them out. And so let's go back to Jesus's family, right? It's where it started. And now what we're going to see is this. And when his family heard it, they went out to seize him, for they were saying he's out of his mind. So what's going on here? Why does his family think he's crazy? What were their concerns? Now, first off, Mark doesn't really tell us. That's usually a good sign that it's not that important, because I think, honestly, it would be more of a distraction of the points he's wanting to make. But here's the deal. I'm curious about it. I think some of you probably are too. And so let's just indulge a little bit and say, okay, what might be some of their family's concerns? First off, we have the luxury of hindsight. We can look back on Jesus and say, obviously he was the Savior. You know, obviously he was the King. They didn't have that knowledge. To them, they were living in the moment. And so things weren't quite as clear. Even Mary, you know, I wondered for the longest time, like Mary had all these things that happened before. How could she like be a part of this? How could she not see? But think about this. I mean, this is not how you would plan for someone to actually present themselves as God's son, his representative. I'm pretty sure that Mary didn't think that this was the route that Jesus was going to take to like be the son of God and to redeem and be the Messiah. And so, you know, I could see why maybe she's concerned. Maybe he's got off track a little bit. We need to help him out. We don't know, but here might be some of their concerns. First of all, Jesus, and it's funny to me how like some things don't change, you know, even in cultures. These are still some of the things that I worry about as a parent. Jesus is not pursuing a career. You know, he doesn't have a stable income. He was the oldest child. You know, he has certain responsibilities to live up to. He's not contributing his fair share in the family, all right? I could see that. I have that concern. You know, I want my kids to be stable. And so, you know, that's one of the things I worry about. That's probably one of the things they were concerned about. Second, Jesus was keeping bad company. Any parents in here, like, worried about who your kids are hanging out with, right? I mean, this is totally relatable. You know, like, Jesus, you know, look at who he's hanging out with. They're a bad influence. I'm sure they've turned him, right? Son of God, they have made him into something he's not supposed to be. And then even worse than that, he's going off and intentionally offending the religious authorities. You know, you're supposed to respect authority. And Jesus is, like, intentionally making them mad. He's ostracizing himself from the community. And certainly this is probably not very good for the family's reputation. And the thing, nothing points to this getting better. It's only going to get worse. And so it's like Jesus' family probably saying, we've had enough. All right, enough's enough. We got to go get him and do damage control. And so maybe for concern for his well-being, maybe out of concern for their reputation, probably a little bit of both, they go to seize Jesus. You know, that's the speculation. But what is Mark trying to tell us by wrapping this story around the scribes? You know, his encounter with the scribes, basically, Mark is linking these two things. He's linking these two things together because he wants us to see these two groups together. There's something about them that's the same. The entire passage is highlighting those who are on the inside, right? Versus those who are left on the outside of what Jesus is doing. And ironically, we would think if there was any two groups that would be on the inside of what Jesus is doing, it would be his family, who are linked to him biologically, and it would be the religious leaders who have knowledge of what the Messiah is supposed to do and look like. And yet these are the two groups that have been left on the outside. And what I think that says here is that, you know, access to Jesus, it has nothing to do with your ethnicity or your gender or your social status or your biology, and it has everything to do with how you respond to him. And that's a beautiful thing. It's open to anybody. It doesn't matter about, again, how the world sees you. And it's interesting, we talk about being on the inside and the outside. I think Mark actually uses spatial imagery to give us this hint that surprisingly his family's on the outside. I want you to read this very last section with me. It's kind of shocking. Honestly, it makes me a little uncomfortable. But this is what Mark says. This is how he closes it out. He says, and his mother and his brothers, right, they came to seize him. They came standing on the outside. And they went to him and called him, and the crowd was sitting around Jesus, and they said to him, your mother and your brothers are outside seeking you. And he answered them. And this is a shocking statement. Who are my mother and my brothers? And then he looks around at the people that are sitting in his circle, and he says, here are my mother and my brothers, for whoever does the will of God, he is my mother and sister and brother. Again, have I mentioned, this makes me a little uncomfortable. It's like, what in the world is Jesus doing here? Cultural protocol in that day would have said that Jesus was obligated to honor his parents. I mean, even as adult, Jewish children were supposed to honor their parents' authority as well as their family. You see, unlike our culture that, you know, we live in a culture today that prizes individualism. But the Jewish culture in Jesus' day was a lot different. It was a society where you found your identity in your family. They were almost like synonyms for one another. They were interchangeable. And so as an individual's family was essentially their life, if you were to reject that or to be cast out of that, you were basically losing your life and your identity. But just let that sink in for a minute. To lose your family is to lose your identity, to lose your life. Now, as shocking as this might be for you and me, it would have been infinitely more shocking to Jesus' family that we're witnessing this scene. You know, Mark doesn't even tell us that they're let in. They just, I guess, have to leave. And I think it's supposed to be shocking. I think it's supposed to take us back. I think it's supposed to cause us to stop and to wonder, like, what do I do with this? This is like out of my comfort zone stuff here. And I want you to catch this. I think this is what's going on. I've thought a lot about it. Jesus is redefining where our identity comes from. You see, who Jesus says I am is supposed to take precedence over how I'm defined by the world and its structures of authority, whether it's the church or even the most foundational ones like my family. Who Jesus says I am takes precedence. And you and I, if we've claimed Jesus and if we've claimed to be his and he's claimed us, then we are called to see ourselves first and foremost, not as a part of our biological families. I don't think he's not devaluing those. Those are important. But we are not to see ourselves first and foremost as a part of our immediate biological family. We're to see ourselves first as members of a new family that has come to exist because of the kingdom of God that Jesus has now established. Do you see yourself first that way? That's a challenge for all of us. I could tell you this, it would have been a greater challenge for this group that's around Jesus. But I also think it would be a greater comfort because you see, like for me, I've got a great family. I love my family. I mean, this is hard for me to kind of wrap my head around because of that. But imagine being one of those all through the years. I mean, it really, where you have lost your family because you have chosen Jesus. And think about the comfort that this would have provided them. Yeah, Jesus is saying, yeah, you've lost one family, but you've gained a bigger one. You've gained a better one. You are part of my family. You're not alone. And just think of the comfort that would provide those that have lost so much for following Jesus. So, so powerful. And so here's the deal. As we conclude, I want to once again reemphasize, I think, what has been the heart of this passage. It's the old ways can't contain the new that Jesus is bringing and has brought. The old structures, the old ways of living, the old, even the authorities, they cannot contain the new. They're just floppy disk, right? Compared to what Jesus, the newness that he's brought. And what this does, it does it for the people in Mark's gospel, and I think it does it for us as well. It forces us to ask a question. That's what Mark does. There's this like secrecy motif, this theme that goes throughout the book of Mark, where Jesus is like he's telling people not to announce who he is. And I think one of the main reasons for that is because Jesus wants people to look at him and see what he's doing and come up with that conclusion on their own. They're forced with a decision, just like we are. Each person in Mark's gospel and each person here, you know, we have to answer the question, who do you say Jesus is? And I would say even more importantly than that, how are you going to respond to him? Because you see, in just this short set of verses we've read, we've seen a lot of responses to Jesus. We've seen a set of individuals being driven by a specific set of desires that have really steered their response. You know, you have Israel's religious leaders. I mean, they have gone to the extreme. They are trying to eliminate Jesus in order to protect their own authority, their own power, their own traditions. And even to the point where they're willingly associating themselves with the Romans, but they're unwittingly associating themselves with Satan himself. They are acting as his representatives. They don't even know it. And then you got Jesus' family, another group, right? They have sought to restrain him, seize him, control him, most likely to try to hold up their family's dignity and reputation. That's what drives them. And then what about the crowds? You know, we talked about the crowds that came to Jesus desperate to obtain healing and relief. And I can totally sympathize with that. That's not a bad thing. The fact that they see Jesus and have faith that he would heal them, that's an amazing thing. But I think you could divide the crowd into two kind of categories. Because I guarantee you, there were some in that crowd, they received their miracle and that was good enough. And they just went back to their old life. Improved, but back to their old way of living. But then there were others that we find out about. They got their miracle, but then they recognized that there was something better than the miracle. And they became a part of the people that followed Jesus. Because in Jesus, they saw someone worth following and forsaking their old lives and identities that they had previously known. And so this really, if we're going to take it back to us, it leads me to first of all ask the question. I want you to think about it for a minute. What drives you? What drives you? Is it comfort? Is it security? Is it status? Maybe it's respect or authority. Maybe it's addiction. Maybe it's your health or wealth or family. Maybe it's just that next promotion or that next season of life that I'm just trying to get to. Maybe it's trying to find happiness through like some type of pleasure or entertainment or worldly fulfillment. I don't know what it is. But I think we're all tempted in one way or another to have something drive us other than following Jesus. And not that all these things are bad. You know, some of this, those things that I just listed are good things. They're just not ultimate things. And yet it's so easy for us to fall into the trap of trying to use Jesus as a means of getting something else that we want. I think this kind of shows through even in our prayer life, right? We think of Jesus as kind of a genie or saying that just if you'll give me this or give me this or give me, I do that. You know, I catch myself doing that. And we treat Jesus as if he is a means to an end. But here's the message of the gospel. The message of Jesus is that he is not some means to a better end. He is the end. He is the end. He's it. He's the source of all that other good stuff that you want. He is better than anything else we could set our sights on. He is the treasure worth pursuing, and he is the one whom we find life in, and a new name, and a new identity. And we have a name for the type of person that's recognized this. We call them disciples. See, a disciple is someone who's seen who Jesus is, seen he's better, and wants to follow. Now, here's the thing about discipleship. Disciples aren't perfect. Just go read the rest of the book of Mark. His disciples are a mess. It's not like they had it all figured out. Discipleship is a process. And within that process, you've got a lot of failure. You got a lot of falling down. And so if you're that, you're in good company because we all fail and we all fall down. That doesn't define whether you're a disciple or not. What defines if you're a true disciple is disciples always find their way back to the feet of Jesus. And not because of anything of their own merit or strength or knowledge, but because they recognize, they hear the voice of Jesus calling them, and they recognize the beauty and the supremacy and the ultimacy of Jesus. And they recognize that he's continually calling them. And sometimes that call comes in different ways. In fact, you know, even through a message like this, there may be some of you that have strayed and kind of wandered and you've fallen and you failed and you think that's it. And right now, Jesus is calling you back. He's fighting for you still. He doesn't stop fighting. And so there may be some here hearing that call and you need to respond. I don't know what that looks like. We're going to have a time where I think Mike just is going to come up before we have communion and just play softly. And I just want to give you a couple minutes. You know, a couple minutes to just ask yourself, you know, where are you today? What is driving your attitudes and your decisions? And are you seeing Jesus for who he is? And for some of you, maybe it's just sitting down and just praying. For others, maybe it's kneeling. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's even coming up to the altar. I don't know. You do what you need to do to meet with Jesus. And my encouragement to you, if you feel like you've fallen away, Jesus is fighting for you. He's calling you back, and he's waiting for you to respond. So let's just take a few minutes, and let's just get quiet. And instead of listening to me, I want you to listen to Jesus. I want you to open your ears and just listen.
Thanks again for joining us today. If you've accepted Christ or have questions about having a relationship with Jesus, we would love to hear from you. Call us at 360-293-3729 or visit our website anytime. Have a great week, and remember, you are loved by us and by Jesus.